Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the hungry planet right after this. You know, the average American household making between $22,000 and $30,000 a year spends about 16%, or about $5,000 of its income on food. Now, if the household makes between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, that household will spend about 10%, or about $6,000 on food. Now, 12% of American households today purchase organic produce, and they buy from health food stores, organic produce salesmen, and from farmers' markets. Now, that translates into some 34 million people coast to coast and border to border. And already, there are more than 4,000 small organic farms producing organic fruits, vegetables, and meats on 25 acres or less, and they're making $100,000 a year serving this growing specialty market. Some of these farms are as small as 3 acres, and they're located in every state in the Union. You know, old Henry Kaiser summed it up nicely when he said of his business success, find a need and fill it. And here's a need just waiting to be filled. Now, the law school has a program to teach you how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. This is a 5-day school, and it includes lessons on marketing, business plans, growing organic foods, and law. Why don't you call today and order our free 4-hour CD package? Remember, it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational, it's the place to start, and it's free of charge. And the number to call, 417-273-4967. Just call and order it, and that's our free general law CD package. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page and download it right there, georgegordon.org, and go to the archives page. All right, last time we were talking about price rises and inflation. Today I want to talk about GMOs, the GMO equation. Today, since World War II, we've engaged in hybridized seed, chemical and pesticide farming, or chemical farming, in order to solve the problems of a growing or burgeoning population explosion or increase. It's what we call in the business unsustainable agriculture. Like our economic system, it is unsustainable. It is coming to a finite conclusion. Inflation comes to a finite conclusion or an end game, because it's unsustainable. It works for a while, and then it reaches a critical mass, and then it collapses. Population growth reaches a finite conclusion. The population increase of 100 million people a year here on planet Earth is unsustainable. There comes a point in time when there will not be enough room on the planet to stand. Long before you reach that end or that conclusion, the population explosion or the population increase will come to an end. In jackrabbit populations in the desert, you start with a pair of jackrabbits. There's plenty to eat, so you go from 2 to 4. There's plenty to eat, so you go from 4 to 8, 16, 32, 64, and the populations grow exponentially, and they double and double and double and double. But at a point in time, the exponential doubling reaches a critical mass when there's just exactly enough food for this population. When the population doubles, with a food supply that will only sustain one half of the population, there is a sudden and abrupt die-off. It doesn't kill them all. They do not all starve to death. They do not all die. But the population will collapse. And that population collapse, in human terms, is a collapse of civilization. You go back to something different. Something's going to change. And when this occurs, either by war or soil destruction, monoculture, fiat paper money, disease, earthquake, whenever that event transpires, or whenever it has transpired in the past, a local civilization has collapsed and died, like the Roman Empire, the Egyptian, Babylonian, Assyrian, Hitler's Third Reich. There's an event that transpires that puts it out of business. Now, last time we were talking about inflation. Now, inflation is going to, of and by itself, destroy the Earth's civilization if it's allowed to continue on. And it's already unsustainable. It is continuing on. Nobody is bringing it under control. Nobody is trying to stop it. How long does it take to do that? Well, it only takes about 3 to 5 days for hyperinflation to set in. When it reaches critical mass, it'll collapse. When it collapses, Americans will no longer be able to get foodstuffs from China. trade will disintegrate. And when that occurs, you will not be able to get the goods that you're now importing. This is why it will become necessary and imperative for the survivors to produce their own food. So the people who have the best chance of surviving in this environment are going to be those that live out in the country and can produce their own. People that have open pollinated seed, people that have a piece of ground, people that know how to use the seed and the ground that they've got to produce the foodstuffs that they need while the population collapses around them. Those will be the people that have the best shot at surviving this population collapse. Those that don't believe a population collapse is possible are the ones who will suffer first because they have no preparations or plans for it. Their only option then is to take it from those who do have it. This then produces conflict. The conflict will resolve itself over time. Sometimes the strong destroy the weak in order for the strong to survive, but most often the weak band together and destroy the strong because there are more weak than there are strong. There are more of the poor than there are of the rich. So that being the case, then the poor band together and then they kill the rich. This is what we saw in the French Revolution back in 1790. Then we start all over again. When the collapse of the society occurs, then we start all over again, and the strong, the rich, then come back in, take over, and direct the poor. The poor always follow the rich. It's never the other way around. So it's the rich that cause the collapse of the civilization. Then the poor who survive it kill off the rich. The surviving in the rich then come back, take over, and run the thing back up again until it reaches collapse. And this cycle goes on and on and on and on. The poor never learn, and neither do the rich. History is never a final arbiter or educator of either the poor or the rich. The cycle simply repeats itself over and over and over again. So the conclusion is that there are always survivors, and there are always victims. So if you want to be one of the survivors, then if you are aware of and you know that the cycle is about to cycle again, either at the top or at the bottom, then that's the time for you to separate yourself from the rest of the lemmings, let them march into the sea, while you go off in the corner someplace and breed and reproduce. I mean, that's the logical solution. Now, last time we were talking about this inflation cycle. Venezuela's 30% inflation is among the world's highest. This oil-rich country is a major food importer, and its bolivar has tumbled against the dollar, forcing up prices in local markets. In April, food prices rose 11% over the previous month. Now, here's a rich country, has plenty of oil to sell, has plenty of foreign exchange, but they're unable to manage their economy. They're run by socialists. Their population is peopled by socialists. And oven by itself, its paper money is going to drive it into famine. It's always happened in the past, and there isn't any reason to believe it isn't going to happen again in the future. So if you live in Venezuela, you're at that part or in that point of the cycle that you need to take action. Now, the Venezuelan government has imposed price controls and arrested some shopkeepers for violating these price controls. But the controls have led to shortages of beef, sugar, corn, meal, and butter, forcing the government to allow some prices to rise by 20% this year. Elsewhere, rising prices highlight a more basic problem, making sure that farm productivity keeps pace with burgeoning population. India's food prices were up 17% in April over a year earlier, but the government hopes normal rainfall this growing season will increase supplies. They hope. The rise has been driven in part by growing demand from the rural poor who can afford to spend more on food thanks to government debt relief and job creation programs. Longer term, experts say that India, with more than a billion people, has to speed up growth in farm production if it is to keep up with demand. Our capacity to feed every Indian is systemically declining with time, said Harsh Mindor, who was appointed by India's Supreme Court to monitor hunger. World markets cannot bail us out. Notice here, our capacity to feed every Indian is systematically declining with time. All right, let's try it this way. When I was a kid, India's population was 300 million. Today, it's a billion plus. It's moved up by three times. All right. Well, if India's population has multiplied by three in 70 years, let's multiply India's population by 3 over the next 70 years, okay? So it moves from 3 to 6, and from 6 to 1.2, okay? So you go 3, 6, 1.2. Now let's take 1, you got a billion today, or 1.2 billion today, so you go 1, 2, 4. Over the next 70 years, you can expect India's population to hit 4 billion. But not one new acre is going to be added to India's size. So that means that each acre has to produce four times more food to feed four times more people. Okay, let's suppose they're able to do that. Now just take 4 and multiply that 8, 16, 32. And India's size is not going to move up by so much as 1 acre. But now they have to produce 32 times more food in 140 years. Can you see where we're going with this, boys and girls? At some point in time, it breaks down. When is it going to break down? I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I didn't come here to tell you to listen to me because I'm a prophet. I said, at some point in time, it's going to break down. You don't need to be a math whiz. You don't have to be a Rhodes scholar to put two and two together. Now, God in the Bible tells you there's a breakdown coming. It's called the Great Tribulation. To meet that, mankind has gone off on a tangent and has decided for, of, and by itself that we're going to go into chemical agriculture. We did that after World War II. We had a choice. It's either organic agriculture or it's chemical agriculture. And our leaders, our college-degreed people, our intellectuals and our professors and the politically correct said this is the course that we want to follow. Throughout history, all of us vulgars have followed the professionals. It's always led us to grief, but we have always followed the professionals and the professors rather than to follow God and to follow the law of God. So my prediction would be we're going to get about the same outcome that we have always gotten in the past. A breakdown in civilization, a punishment, a conclusion to our broken laws. Every time you break a law, there's a penalty. And my prediction would be, just looking at history, the way it's always been in the past, you're going to get about the same result that you got the last time, and the time before that, and the time before that, which was death and destruction. Now, when we take a look at food and agriculture, and the use of pesticides, as it impacts upon us by the use of GE crops, genetically engineered crops, genetically modified organisms, we were told 13 years ago that if we would go with GE crops, we will use less pesticides, have less impact on the environment and the ecology, and we will produce more food, and that will be the salvation of higher and higher population growths. All right? So let's take a look and see where we're at. This report documents pesticide use increases on GE crops. The impacts of genetically engineered crops on pesticide use in the first 13 years are as follows. A November 2009 report from the Organic Center, Impacts of Genetically Engineered Crops on Pesticide Use in the United States. The first 13 years shows a dramatic rise in the use of glyphosate weed killers called herbicides on genetically engineered crops. The Union of Concerned Scientists and five other NGOs funded this work. Using a model developed to assess the overall impact of GE crops on pesticide use, reports the author and Organic Center chief scientist, Dr. Charles Benbrook, determined that 383 million additional pounds of herbicides have been used on genetically engineered crops since 1996, compared to what would have been used if GE crops had been replaced by conventional non-GE varieties. 46% of the total increase occurred in the last 2 years studied. That's in 2007 and 2008. All right, now let's just pause here for a moment. Now, down in the Gulf of Mexico, right now, as I speak, there's a blowout of an oil well. Now, that's causing an environmental disaster. Boys and girls, there's a bigger environmental disaster that has already occurred down in the Gulf. And it's called algae bloom. It's called the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River, which drains about, two-thirds of the United States of America. The farmers of America since 1945 have been putting on chemical fertilizers and herbicides on their land. It rains, and when it rains, there's runoff, and when there's runoff, there's a runoff of these chemical herbicides and pesticides, which run down the brooks, into the creeks, down the rivers, into the Mississippi, and out into the Gulf of Mexico, which now totals some several thousand square miles. Just like this big oil slick now covers 36,000 square miles, you have a dead zone down there where nothing grows, which has already been created. Past tense, boys and girls. Much bigger and much more deadly and much more environmentally destructive than the oil spill. Not to say that the oil spill isn't going to be the tipping lever which will push you over the edge, but I'm just pointing out that even without that, the pesticides have them by themselves, which deals with soil destruction. I mean, come on, guys. Let's wake up and smell the coffee here. This has already occurred past tense. Now, the guys come along and they say, we'll save you. Genetically modified, genetically engineered foods will save you. Then we can shrink the dead zone. Oh, no. Now you're putting more in than you were before. It kind of reminds me of the governor of Kansas. Kansas sits astraddle of the Oglala Aquifer, or the Oglala Aquifer, I believe is the way you pronounce it. And this aquifer produces about one half of all of the foodstuffs grown in the United States. This aquifer has been tapped into now since the 1930s. You know, we've got hot and heavy and serious about it. And we drill down into it, and then we put a center pivot out there, and we irrigate 160 acres of ground, and then we grow crops on it. Well, this aquifer has been declining. That is, we're pumping the water out faster than it's recharging. Now, it's got about 20 years of supply left in it. So the governor, who says, we're pumping this thing dry, and we've got to get back to equilibrium to where we take no more out than we're putting in. And so the governor who proposed this moratorium was told in no uncertain terms by everybody, you do that and we vote you out of office. We're going to continue to drill the wells. We're going to continue to pump like we've never pumped before. We're not going to slow down, we're going to speed it up. Well, okay, you got a 20-year supply left, and we're going to pump it out faster so that it doesn't take 20 years, we can do it in 15. Boys and girls, when that thing goes dry, it's going to be as dry as it is in the Texas Panhandle where it's already gone dry. That's unsustainable. Half your food comes from that aquifer. Wake up and smell the coffee here. You can keep doing that until it runs dry. It's going to run dry. It's like running the Titanic at 23 knots into 5,000 square miles of icebergs. Hey, wake up here, wake up. You're going to hit an iceberg, and when you do, your ship is going to sink. Don't you think you ought to slow down, steer south, and change the dynamics of this problem? And the answer by the farmers and the people of Kansas was, hell no, we won't go, and we're going to drill more, not less, more. All right. Now, if you want to ride that ship, you know, let me give you my stateroom. I'm getting off. Why don't you just go right ahead? Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and your success. Going on. They went on to say that, drawing upon U.S. Department of Agriculture data, Dr. Benbrook shows that this huge increase in glyphosate herbicide use swamps the decrease in insecticide use attributable to GE corn and cotton, making the overall chemical footprint of today's GE crops decidedly negative. The report identifies the primary cause of the increase, the emergence of glyphosate-resistant weeds due to the increased use of glyphosate on the widely planted GE glyphosate-tolerant soybeans, corn, and cotton. Now, as a consequence, weed control is now widely acknowledged as a serious management problem, particularly in the Southeast, but increasingly so across the heartland. Today's report calls into question the biotechnology industry's assertions that GE crops have reduced pesticide use. Just a few months ago, the UCS released a report, Failure to Yield, which faulted the industry for yet another misleading claim 13 years ago, that of increased yield. Failure to Yield found that GE crops have largely failed to increase crop yield, despite 20 years of research and 13 years of commercialization. Assessments like these of the performance of GE crops, while valuable in connecting the excesses of industry, advertising, they're about the future direction of agriculture. According to its advertising campaigns, the biotechnology industry promises to solve the twin challenges of climate change and a burgeoning world population, just as it once promised to reduce agriculture's chemical impact. Before embracing GE crops as a solution to these new challenges, independent data-driven appraisals of its record on earlier pledges are needed. And yet the USDA has been essentially silent on the impacts of GE crops on pesticide use for almost a decade. This is why UCS and other NGOs commissioned this study by Dr. Benbrook. Now, we hope that these reports and others like them will help trigger new government and academic assessments of the performance, the costs, and the risks associated with today's genetically engineered crops. Without such assessments, American agriculture is likely to continue down the road preferred by the biotechnology industry, which is a path that promises to maximize their profits, but it ignores existing, promising, and often lower-cost alternative solutions. This is unsustainable, and it will reach a tipping point at some indefinite time in the future. Boys and girls, I would suggest for you and I that we get off this ship before it hits the iceberg. Now, to help you do just that, there's a book here called Genetic Roulette by Jeffrey M. Smith. Now, I've already reported on this book, and I'm not going to do a second report. But if you'll go back to our archives, you'll see that there is a full report on Genetic Roulette, the documented health risks of genetically engineered foods. Now, if you rely upon genetically engineered foods going into the upcoming famine, you will become one of the victims, one of that 90% that doesn't see the light of day on the other side of the Great Tribulation. Now, religious people are in hopes of surviving the Great Tribulation by being protected by God Himself in what they call the rapture. I hope that there is a rapture for all of you people, 70 million strong, expecting this God-ordained salvation. Because without it, you people are dead. D-E-D, dead on arrival. Now, not being one of the saved myself, I'm not relying upon the rapture. I'm relying upon Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Revelation 6, Deuteronomy 28, and Leviticus 26, which plainly tells us, here's what's coming, get ready. Genetic Roulette will help you do that. It'll tell you why genetic engineered foods are going to kill you. They are poison. It's slow poison. It doesn't kill you today, tomorrow, or next week. It just weakens your immune system until an opportunistic disease strikes, and then you will die from that opportunistic disease. And your death certificate will never read killed by genetic roulette. It will never say that you were killed by or you died from genetically engineered food. Your death certificate will say that you died from the flu or from pneumonia or from some other cause. But the bottom line is, you died from genetic roulette. It was the second book by Jeffrey M. Smith. And it was called Seeds of Destruction. And I did a complete report on that book also several years back. Go to our archives and you can pull down that one, Seeds of Destruction, coupled with Genetic Roulette. Both books well documented and shows you the answers to the riddle on genetically modified foods. Now, you can avoid genetic foods if you put your mind to it. Most people don't, they won't, and they don't care. Neither do I. I don't care. We just report the facts, and we don't really care whether you listen to it or not, but we think that you should at least know why you're dying, why you were killed, why this is happening to you. So this is the other side of that story. Now remember this failure to yield part of the story? All right, well, hang on here. I've got to give you the mid-course reminder. If I can find my paper. Mid-course reminder here. And maybe I will not give you a mid-course reminder if I can't hear this. Can't find it. Which will make all of the FCC agencies and government bureaucrats around the world salivate. We caught Gordon over here and he didn't give us a station identification. So let me do that right now and settle down all of you bureaucrats out there by reminding you that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book Hungry Planet. You can get a copy of it from Baker Creek Seeds. Baker Creek Seeds, Mansfield, Missouri. You can also go to the Baker Creek website, Baker Creek, and it's heirloomseeds.com, heirloomseeds.com. Now, while you're at it, be sure that you write down Genetic Roulette. I think you can also get that one from Baker Creek Seeds. Jeffrey M. Smith is the author, and Seeds of Deception. Jeffrey M. Smith, Seeds of Deception. If you want to call him first, I don't have a phone number for him, but you can get some information. Just look for Baker Creek Seeds, Mansfield, Missouri. And you'll get somebody there. Tell me you're looking for these books that you heard about here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. All right, now let's take a look at this. Failure to yield. The Union of Concerned Scientists issued a briefing in July of 2009, and they said that genetic engineering has been touted as a major solution to the global hunger problems that are expected to worsen as the world's population grows. But a new analysis of this industry's nearly 20-year record in the United States shows that, despite the proponents' claims, genetic engineering has actually done very little to increase the yields of food and of feed crops. Given such a track record, it appears unlikely that this technology will play a leading role in helping the world to feed itself in the foreseeable future. There's a new urgency prompted by the recent spikes in food prices around the world to boost global food production in order to feed a rapidly growing population. In response, the biotechnology industry has made optimistic claims about the ability of genetically engineered crops in which the plant DNA is changed using spliced genes that are often from unrelated organisms to substantially increase farmers' yields. But are those claims valid? For the answer, the Union of Concerned Scientists carefully examined the industry's record in the United States, where GE crops have now been commercially grown since the mid-1990s and where the best and most extensive data are available. Because our focus was food production, we reviewed the data on soybeans and corn, the main GE food feed crops. Soybeans engineered for herbicide tolerance currently account for more than 90% of all U.S. soybean acres planted, and GE corn makes up 63% of the national corn crop. Within the GE corn varieties, some are engineered for herbicide tolerance, others contain genes from the Bacillus BT bacterium, which render the plants resistant to several kinds of insect pests, and some have both types of genes. Now that these crops have been grown commercially for 13 years, there is now a wealth of data on yield under well-controlled conditions. And our investigation of yield data for these GE crops shows that genetic engineering has not lived up to its promise. And as described in our report, Failure to Yield, Evaluating the Performance of Genetically Engineered Crops, we found that since the commercial introduction of GE food crops in the United States, number one, herbicide-tolerant soybeans and corn have not increased yields any more than conventional methods that rely on commonly available herbicides. Two, insect-resistant BT corn varieties have provided an average yield advantage of just 3 to 4%. Compared to typical conventional practice, including synthetic insecticide use. Meanwhile, non-GE plant breeding and farming methods have increased yields of major grain crops by values ranging from 13 to 25%. Now, the real dirt on genetic engineering and crop yield is as follows. There are two kinds of crop output measures, intrinsic yield and operational yield. And so if you've got a pen and paper and you want to keep track of the score here, you write down two columns, and at the top of column one, intrinsic yield, I-N-T-R-I-N-S-I-C yield, and operational yield, O-P-E-R-A-T-I-O-N-A-L yield, two columns. Intrinsic yield reflects what could be achieved if the crops were grown under ideal conditions. It also may be thought of as potential yield. By contrast, operational yield is what is obtained under actual field conditions, where plants are subject to pests, drought stress, and other environmental factors. Genes that improve operational yield do so by reducing losses from such factors. But because they do not also increase potential yield, they will probably not be sufficient to meet future food demand. In examining the record of GE crops in raising both types of yield, here's what we found. One, genetic engineering has not increased the intrinsic yield. No currently available GE varieties enhance the intrinsic yield of any crops. The intrinsic yields of corn and soybeans did rise during the 20th century, but not as a result of GE traits. Rather, these increases were done due to successes in traditional breeding of crops. Two, genetic engineering has delivered only minimal gains in operational yield. The best available data suggests that HT soybeans and corn have not increased operational yields in the United States, whether on a per acre or on a national basis compared to conventional methods that rely upon available herbicides. BT corn varieties engineered to protect plants from either the European corn borer or the corn root worm have fared better, but only slightly so. They provide an operational yield advantage of 7 to 12% compared to typical conventional practices, including insecticide use, but only when insect infestations are high. Otherwise, BT corn offers little or no advantage, even when compared to non-GE corn not treated with insecticides. Both varieties of BT corn together provide an estimated operational yield increase of about 3 to 4% averaged across all of the corn acres, given that most corn acreage does not have high infestations of target insects. When averaged over the 13 years since 1996, when BT corn was first commercialized, this result amounts to a 0.2% operational yield increase per year. Most yield gains are attributable to non-genetic engineered approaches. Now, the biotechnology industry promotes the idea that GE technology has steadily increased U.S. farm productivity over the past 13 years. But while the U.S. Department of Agriculture data do show rising crop yields nationwide over that period, most of those gains cannot be attributed to the adoption of GE crops. So let's take the case of corn, which is the most widely grown crop in the United States. Corn yields increased on average about 1% per year, and the last several decades of the 20th century considerably more in total than the yield increase provided by BT corn varieties. More recently, the USDA data have indicated that the average corn production per acre nationwide over the past 5 years, from 2004 to 2008, was 28% higher than for the five-year period 1991 through 1995, an interval that preceded the introduction of BT varieties. But on the basis of our analysis of specific yield studies, we concluded that only 3 to 4% of that increase was attributable to BT, meaning that an increase of 25% must have resulted from the other factors, such as, but not limited to, the traditional breeding of seed crops. No increase at all was attributable to GEHT corn. Zero, zero, zero. Yields have also risen in other grain crops, but that's not because of GE. For example, total U.S. soybean yield has increased 16% since the early to mid-90s, yet our analysis of the data suggests that GE technology has produced neither intrinsic nor operational yield gains in commercialized varieties. Perhaps most striking is the case of wheat, where yields have risen 13% during this period of time, in the absence of any commercially grown GE varieties. Number four, experimental high-yield genetically engineered crops have not succeeded despite considerable effort by the industry and government intervention. The USDA records show that GE crop developers have applied to conduct thousands of experimental field trials since 1987. More than 650 of the applications specifically named yield as the target trait, while some 2,400 others listed target traits including disease resistance and tolerance to environmental stresses such as drought, frost, flood, or saline soil, often associated with yield. But only the BT and HT varieties discussed above, along with five disease-resistant varieties grown on limited acreage, advanced from the experimental stage and are now being grown commercially. If the numerous other yield-enhancing test varieties were going to achieve results worthy of commercialization, at least some of them would have done so by now. Now, increasing crop yields, and at what crop and at what cost? Engineering crops for increased yield is a difficult proposition, and unlike BT and HT genes, most genes that control yield also influence many other genes. These complex genetic interactions typically have multiple effects on the plant, and early research is confirming that such effects can be detrimental. Even when the added yield-enhancing genes work as expected, they may actually diminish the crop's agricultural value in other ways. In some cases, these genes may also have a variety of indirect but no less important impacts. Since their beginning, GE crops have sparked considerable public controversy, with the critics warning of possible adverse health effects, including new allergies or toxicity when these foods are eaten. Environmental impacts such as the creation of new or more aggressive weeds, and economic outcomes as in the contamination of other food crops with these new genes. With their greater genetic complexity, crops specifically engineered for increased yield will likely present even more side effects which will not always be identified under existing regulatory requirements. Thus, improved regulations will need to ensure that harmful side effects are discovered and then prevented. Now, alternatives provide greater promise. GE crops have received huge investments of public and private research dollars since their introduction. Yet, their minimal gains in yield stand in sharp contrast with the past gains and future potential of a suite of alternatives that require more modest initial investment and risk fewer potentially adverse aspects or impacts. Traditional breeding has already proven itself capable of steadily increasing crop yields, and the newer and more modern breeding methods are emerging. For example, high-tech genomic approaches, often called marker-assisted selection, use biotechnology, but they do not use genetically engineered to speed up the selection process for desired traits without actually inserting new genes from other species that could not mate with the crop. These approaches also have the potential to increase both intrinsic and operational yield. Studies increasingly show the promise of agroecological farming methods. For example, farmers have long known that more extensive crop rotations using a large number of crops and longer rotations can cut losses from insect pests and disease. Such approaches also entail less reliance on pesticides than the corn-soybean rotations that currently dominate U.S. crop production. And research on low external input methods, which limit the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, show that they can produce yields comparable to those of industrial-style conventional production methods. See the chart on page 6 for an example of GE soybeans in recent low external input U.S. experiments produced yields 13% higher than those of GE soybeans, although other low external input research and methods have shown lower yield. So the high-tech genome approaches, often called the marker-assisted selection, use biotechnology, but they do not use bioengineering to speed up the selection process for desired traits without actually inserting any new genes from other species that could not mate with the crop. Now, these approaches also have the potential to increase both intrinsic and operational yields for farmers. Now, it's important to keep in mind that where increased food production is most needed, it's in the developing countries, especially in Africa, rather than in the developing world or the developed world like the United States and Canada. Recent studies in these countries have shown that low external input methods can improve yield by more than 100%, and that there are other benefits. Such methods are largely based on farmer knowledge rather than on costly inputs from synthetic pesticides and GE seeds, and as a result, they're often more accessible to poor farmers. Considering these advantages, a recent internal and international assessment supported by the World Bank, several United Nations agencies, numerous governments, several hundred scientists and other experts recommended that GE, genetically engineered plants, play a secondary role to organic and other low external input farming methods. The assessment also recommended improvements in infrastructure, such as better water harvesting and grain storage, and the building of new roads for marker access. All right, let's take a look here now at what we're talking about. Over the past 13 years, we were promised by the GE, that's Monsanto, that these crops, genetically engineered, were going to vastly improve productivity. They haven't. Then they told us it's going to have a smaller ecological impact. They don't. Then they said we're going to use less chemical fertilizers and less herbicides to grow them. And they haven't. They use more. Now, already, boys and girls, the agricultural model that we adopted after World War II is not sustainable. We have to cut back on the use of chemicals and pesticides and herbicides. In short, we have to move back to organic agriculture if we're going to have sustainability. We're not moving back to organics. We are moving dead ahead on more chemicals. Then we compounded the problem with genetic engineering, which we were told, don't do that. Now let me show you where. Now the creator of the universe who designed all of these plants came up with a law here, and he said, now listen, let me tell you how this works. It's in Leviticus 19, verse 19. And he said, you shall keep my statutes, and you shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind, and you shall not sow your field with mingled seed, and neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon you. Three instructions in one verse. Instruction number two in the verse says, you shall not let you shall not sow your seed or your field with mingled seed. Now, mingled seed is called hybridized seed. Hybridization actually does produce more in the way of tons or bushels per acre. And there's a seed that's called open pollinated seed. Open pollinated seed is the natural seed that God designed in the Garden of Eden, and it works like a shot. And that seed actually reproduces, and it produces more of the products, more of the nutrients for which we grow the product or the seed to start with. In other words, the reason that we grow a plant is for the nutritional value that's in it. Now, if we take a look at seed, that is wheat, grown in Kansas in the 1880s, it produced 24% protein. Today, on that same land, growing the new hybridized varieties, it grows 7 to 13%. So it's down by about half. Why? Well, Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds, compared to more than 4,000 samples of this hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year. Steinbrom's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein than the hybrid varieties, 875% more copper than the hybrid varieties, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese, and the same result has been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. Now, boys and girls, the reason that we eat these foods is to get these nutrients out of it. And when we eat this hybridized product from hybridized seed, we get 75% less protein. Now we've compounded the product. Now we've gone from open-pollinated to hybrid, and from hybrid to genetically engineered, which produces even less. Boys and girls, that's what we call unsustainable. You've got to have more and more nutrients in your food, not less and less. And if you have less and less nutrients, you have more and more disease, for which you now need more and more doctors, and more hospitals, and more national health care insurance. Let's hear it for genetic engineering, huh? Hey, I'm out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If I can find my paper here. Here we go. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-private, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly for our radio log schedule and archives. I'm out of time. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friend.